To dive into today's gospel today, it's good to orient ourselves a little bit to the landscape around us in the season and in the scriptures. First thing to note is that on this Sunday, the third Sunday of Lent, we make a shift in the liturgical layout of the season. Every year on the first and second Sunday, we always hear the same gospel stories. First Sunday, the temptation in the desert from Matthew, Mark, or Luke's perspective. Second Sunday, his transfiguration from Matthew, Mark, and Luke's perspective. And then every year when we get to Sunday number three, we get to the heart or the kernel of the season, you might say. Sundays 3, 4, and 5 are a group and they shift every year. So today we shift. And in this particular year, the theme is going to be picked up on by what John laid out today, this idea of predictions of the dying and the rising of Jesus. This is called the Paschal Mystery Cycle in this particular year. So this Sunday, next Sunday, and the one after that, 3, 4, and 5, will all have the same theme. It's Jesus telling about his coming, dying, and rising, and how that will be a source of authority, salvation, and redemption, because he enters into the fundamental pattern of our lives. We're all doing the dying and rising all the time. So that is shift number one, or landscape orientation piece that we should first have in our heads today. We move today to a new batch of text. Second thing is that we are going to be in John's Gospel now for the next few Sundays. We should know some things about John. Beautiful Gospel, richly put together and carefully laid out text. And the more that I study, the more amazed I am by how beautiful it is. And there's a lot going on below the surface in John's Gospel all throughout it. So we should know this about it. One of his central themes he's always driving at goes kind of like this. John has Jesus presenting himself, revealing himself, and thereby revealing God to the world. So Jesus says, "Here I am," if you will. And then John has people responding. God shows himself, people react. This is the twofold dynamic that's always going on in John. And we have to know that to understand about today's gospel story and the next couple Sundays as well. So we've shifted to the Paschal Mystery Cycle. We're in John. John is going to present Jesus to us as a portrait. And we're going to have the chance to respond, just like they did way back then. How does John do that? How does John present the Lord and elicit reactions? He does it in a few ways, through some signs throughout the gospel, through some hard-hitting dialogues throughout the gospel, and through some carefully selected events. In all those ways, Jesus puts himself out there for reactions. So today is the last one. This is an event. This is what John is trying to help us see who Jesus was. He presents him in this particular situation that was pivotal and stuck in the memories of the first Christian community. Which brings us, therefore, landscape laid out now, to this chunk of text from John and the story of the cleansing of the temple. What does this mean exactly? How do we understand its mystery and its power? And as you might imagine, as I always say, we could spend hours on this, right? But a couple of points. First of all, it's good to understand a bit about what the temple is. We should know the context of the story in the time period. The Jews held the temple in the highest of regards, the highest of esteem. And if you want a comparison to our own modern day, the temple is sort of a combination of the White House and Capitol Building and St. Peter's Basilica all rolled into one. It's a religious and a political building all at the same time. For them, there was no separation of church and state. It was all one thing. And not only that, as the Sunday's Gospel does show and other texts as well too, it was a place of commerce and trade. It was a marketplace. It had become a place of a depository of wealth, a symbol of Jewish power, a flashpoint for their identity as a nation, a rallying point for what it would mean for the Messiah to come and usher in a new era of control and prosperity for the Jewish people. All that intersected in this sacred building that is at the centerpiece of today's story. This is the temple. We also know, although at the time they did not know this, Jesus did, but they did not, that within about 30 or so years of this story, this building would be totally destroyed. It would be gone. The Romans would come and they would wipe it all out, because they were putting down a revolt of the Jewish people. So its time was coming to an end. And that fact history would make clear very, very shortly to the people of Jerusalem and to the surrounding territories. It was obligatory in the law, in the Jewish Mosaic law, that every male over the age of 12 would have to come up to Jerusalem every year for Passover from the surrounding territories. He made the trip up, and his family came with him if they were able to do so. So we find ourselves, therefore, in this scene, not only in the sacred spot, the temple, the spot of nationalism and authority, but also in a sacred time of the year. This is Passover. In John's Gospel, there are three Passovers. This is the first of them for Jesus, so this is the opening of his public ministry. So that is the scene in which we find ourselves in the story. We also know, back to John's pattern of revelation and response, what happened just before the story. Right before this, he finds himself in Cana at the wedding feast, where he changes all that water into good wine, at the request of his mother. This is important because for John, when it comes to how do you respond to who Jesus is, the best responder in the story is his mother. In the opening of the story at Cana, and at the end, at beneath the cross, in both cases, she responds to his word and to his identity with openness, with totality, with acceptance, and with faith. And she has done so in the verses just before this. So she has set the stage for how things ought to be. Then he goes south, down to Jerusalem, for our story. And here is his debut in the big city. First time the temple has seen him in action. The first time his apostles have seen him in action out of his own home territory. And this is where our story picks up. What does he do? This is the event that John puts out there for reactions. He does something highly, on one level, unusual. He goes to the temple as a pilgrim, as a Passover pilgrim from the countryside, surrounded by all the other pilgrims, and in full view of the Roman authorities who were controlling the city in the Passover high season, in full view of the temple priests who were watching the courtyard where he was, under the noses of the temple guards who were at every single post along the way, he starts a small riot, really. He takes a whip out of cords, and he goes after all those who were doing trade in the courtyard of the temple. This is a bold gesture on his part. Now, on one level, for the Jews, they saw nothing wrong with the trade in the temple. You've been to Holy Hill. What is there? A gift shop. Every Catholic shrine in the world has one. It's just how it works, right? Every pilgrimage place in the Palestinian territories was a place of commerce. It's where you made money. That's how the city ran. You could not bring Roman coins into the temple because on its face was Caesar's image. That was a defilement, so you stopped at the door and changed your money. Then you pay the temple tax, which was obligatory. All this was legal. And what you do there, you had to buy animals to sacrifice. That's why you came in the first place. So you gave your money and you bought your sheep, your goat, your doves. You took those up to the priests, they offered it up, and that was the fulfillment of your annual vow. So all this trade was perfectly normal as they saw it. Centuries had built up to allow all this as a custom to be there. So Jesus seems to take on what is an ingrained, normal, established, legal, perfectly fine, reputable, important set of customs. And he throws them all out. Curiously enough, they don't stop him. The Romans, as I said, who would have been heavy in force during the Passover feast, putting down little riots that were springing up that time because of the messianic excitement of the day, they could have seen all this happening from their guard towers on the north side of the temple. They let him go. Temple guards didn't stop him. The temple priest did not stop him either. That tells us that even though they reacted poorly later on some level they recognized the correctness of the gesture. They wouldn't admit it, but somewhere they knew this was appropriate. What was a gesture? It was prophetic, like out of Jeremiah or the Psalms or maybe Zechariah. What does Jesus want? He wants the purity of his Father's house. Stop making my Father's house a marketplace. This has become corrupt. An age-old practice has become sour. Your worship has become dull. There is a zeal missing from your hearts. In my Father's house, is to be a place of pure worship and proper prayer, and none of this, he says, has any place. Out it must go. This is fully in line with the zeal of the prophets who came centuries before him, and he knows it. It's consistent with his mission, and he knows it. And somehow in the hearts of those around him, they, I think, sense it too, which is why they let him finish it, and then they confronted him. So all this background now, right, is Jesus presenting himself. Here I am, he says. Quite the opening debut, you might imagine, in the big city of Jerusalem. What are the reactions, therefore? This is John's pattern, right? He presents Jesus, he reveals himself, and we get a chance to respond. That's the pattern of the entire gospel. The reactions are multiple. On the one hand, as I said, one reaction to the gospel is that of his mother's. She accepts all this without question. She's opened up by it and changed by it for the better. There's that. There is the reaction, I suppose, of the apostles themselves in this whole little scene. This is the first time they'd watched him in action in Jerusalem. And we know this is interesting because the narrative breaks off here and recounts that they looked back on this event when it was all over with. That's important to know because it tells us the one telling the story stayed with him till the end. What was their reaction? They're mortified. Mortified. As if to say, he's going to get himself killed. What is he doing? What is he up to? But they stayed. Mortified, but faithful. They stayed with him. We know this because of the psalm that they quoted. Zeal for this house will consume me. Psalm 69. The psalm has a way of saying the psalmist knows he's going to be consumed for doing what he did. The onlookers realize he's going to die for doing something like this. That's their first reaction, then and looking back on it. So they're mortified, but they do stay with him. There's that reaction. Then there's the reaction of the authorities who run the temple, who confront him when this is all over with. And they simply ask him, what authority do you have behind you to do this? What sign can you show us to prove that you can do this action? Who are you? Where'd you come from? What are you doing here? This doesn't make any sense, is what they're trying to say. His response will become the same one now throughout the whole gospel. My sign, he says, that I'm going to give you is that if you destroy this temple in 3 days, I will raise it up. We know, looking back, what he's talking about. The temple of his body, and the narrator says the same thing. To their ears, they think he means the building. This has become the theme now. Jesus says, my authority, my justification is not needed because I'm going to hand myself over to death and I will rise and that will be proof enough for you of my authority. But in the moment, they couldn't have possibly understood what he meant. Next 2 Sundays will be the exact same theme over and over again. I'm going to die for you. I will rise to glorify you. That is why I can do these things. But they don't see it. Their eyes are blinded, their ears are closed, their hearts are hard. They will have no part of it. So with that, the curtain falls on this scene. Next Sunday picks up right after it. He'll go see Nicodemus at night, and Nicodemus will try to understand this event that happened during the day. Next Sunday's homily for that. But for now, anyway, this is the pattern. John says, this is Jesus. React. How do you react? Rightly or wrongly? What do we learn from this as I ramble on here this morning with all this background, right? What does this even mean for us? It's good to know the scene, okay, so we spend some time on what all this means. This was a real event. Highly unusual, therefore, extremely unlikely it was made up. This must have happened. What do we take from it? First thing would be this. It is true that God is always seeking to purify. He purifies every institution, all that is sacred, all that we hold dear. He never ever stops trying to drive out whatever is not clean. He wants right worship. He wants proper prayer. He wants purified liturgy. He wants purified religion. He's never done purifying these things. He wants to purify our families and our marriages. And our schools, and our community. He wants to purify our politics and our commerce and our business. He wants to purify our ideas, our concepts, our interactions. He wants to purify our hearts. He wants nothing unclean because he knows that he deserves nothing less than that and that we deserve nothing less than that. So he never stops driving out what does not belong. That is a fact that we must understand from this gospel very, very clearly. The first reading from Exodus, same thing. All the commandments are given to purify. That's what they're for. That's why they're so important. Every single one of them is about purifying the world. First point. Second point, the way that he purifies is never convenient. It always strikes us as hard. Whenever he comes after us with his whip of cords, the reaction is often very, very difficult. It's never what we expect. It's never easy. It's never simple. It's always on his terms and not our own. And we can feel it in life when we find ourselves getting stretched or torn at home, in a marriage, in a job, in a career, in a parish. When things change and shift and come and go, it's all about being purified. So he never stops purifying, and it never happens in the way that we're going to expect. The Jews did not see this coming. We look back at it now and realize it must be, but for the time, they did not see it. And the third point is in the Johannine understanding. We have the chance to react. He purifies on his terms, and then we have the chance to react to it. How do we respond? How do we find ourselves in the same pattern? Jesus says to us all today, here I am, purifying and driving out. How are you going to react? On one hand, there is the faith of his mother. She reacts with a sense of acceptance. And perhaps that's what we all are at today as well. Only you know that. I don't know that. We accept what comes. We take it with patience. We grow from it, transformed by it. That's one way. There is the other hand, the Jews. In this case, that means the temple leaders who react with complete resistance. Lord, you will not touch my job. You will not change my family. You will not interfere with my career. You will not interfere with my worship. You will not change my parish. You'll not change my school. You'll not change my behavior. I want no part of it. That could be the other way to react. Or there's probably the middle, which I think is probably most of us a lot of the time, the place of the apostles, who, while they were mortified over the whole thing, did stay with him till the end. Ran for a bit, doubted for a bit, made some mistakes, but as the entire story shows, in the end, they were still with him, getting changed by the process all along. That, I think, is probably what God wants for us in this Lenten season, to stay with it to the end, to be purified willingly all the way to the end. And that's what Lent is for. The praying, the fasting, the almsgiving, going to confession especially, all that is about becoming pure, purified by God's divine power. But we can't do it if we don't stay with him and are not open to it in the process. So this is the beautiful thing about these next three Sundays. The same theme is said over and over again. It's in the dying and the rising of life that we're purified. It's in the dying and the rising of life that God entered into in his Paschal mystery. That's what makes Christianity so beautifully true. It sanctifies, makes holy, the basic pattern of our existence. We're always going through a letting go and a rising up, and this story is one among many. So the goal that the church invites us into is one of being purified, like that temple. Lord, make my heart pure. Make my family pure. Make my marriage pure, my job pure, my parish, whatever it is, purify every realm, Lord. Do that to me. I accept it willingly in this Lenten season and beyond. That's what we want to be able to do, to let him act on us with his whip of cords, which stings a little bit, but is always, always necessary. As we do that, as he makes each of us pure, every single one of us, through that he purifies the whole world. In that way, the world's transformed, we are saved, and he is praised. May he be praised in his ways, always and forever.